Now, the Mayans, and I continue to talk about this, the Mayans claim the calendar ends, their calendar, December 21st, 2012.
Yeah.
I just read a story out of India that says that we're going to go through a massive polar shift. It could be the end for all of us. What do you say as a physicist, first and foremost, about that date, 2012?
Well, the date seems to be significant. We count our calendar by descendants of days that were actually named by the giants originally, January, February, those kinds of names, March. But the original calendar was one of 13 moons with 28 days in each moon, with one day out of time, they call it, sort of an in-between day. And that's the way time had been reckoned for a long, long time. The Mayan calendar was built by that. Stonehenge was designed along those lines. And they all seem to culminate on the end of a cycle. I guess you can call it, we're right now in the age of Aquarius, if you want to think of it in astrological terms.
Right.
And that date, 2012, ends a cycle where the beginning of this 12,000-year cycle begins over again, or 20,000-year cycle, I'm sorry. And that time, every single civilization records that there will be upheaval. A polar shift has happened before on this planet, and it will happen again.
And I guess that is upheaval, right?
Yes, you get tectonic shift. The planet may tilt again on its axis a different way. It may slow in rotation. It may speed up in rotation. It's difficult to theorize all of the effects that such a shift might have.
There are
things that we don't see in the universe. We only get to see them after their light reaches our telescopes.
Well, that's true, and that could be thousands and thousands, if not millions of years.
And there may be events that have happened in the universe, and there are solid bodies, maybe a planet the size of Venus, traveling at close to the speed of light toward us, which we cannot see yet because its light hasn't reached us. And when its light reaches us, the planet's going to be right behind it.
Well, do you think that in 2012 something is going to happen of some huge magnitude?
My co-author, E.J. Clark, actually went down to South America and tried to do some research on this, tried to talk to people that know the calendar, that know the history of the calendar, that could speak English. And this old-timer that she spoke to, who's locally known as an authority on the calendar, it's rather complicated in its interpretations, but she asked him, what happens December of 2012? And the only word he could come up with was, boom.
Boom. Huh.
So I wouldn't buy any green bananas about that time.
No, not at all. But I kind of think sometimes it might be an era of enlightenment. I hope I'm right, Brooks.
I think so. I'm trying to stay open-minded to this, but I believe that mankind on this planet is, as a whole, on the verge of some kind of metamorphosis. Now, there are many that are not. They're very primitive, and they're still scratching over land or food or oil or something like that. But by and large, the race of man is about to the point where we realize the value of a human life, and we realize our eternal potential, that it's absolutely unlimited, that the abilities that we have stretch far beyond this mortal life, and we need to pay attention to that.
Were you an old Twilight Zone fan by any chance? There's a reason for that. One of our listeners, his name's Bad Boy, he's really not a bad boy, out of San Diego. There was an old Twilight Zone, and I do remember this, that there were two remaining individuals of fighting nations, a man, a woman, and they fled to another planet. They ended up being Adam and Eve, and the planet was later revealed to be Earth. You know what? Who's to say if indeed they did travel here, it might have been something like that as well. They had to escape, for example. Who knows?
Well, that's another story, isn't it? But it sure is fascinating. Yeah. I'll tell you an episode that really affected me. It was Star Trek Next Generation. And there was a probe outside the ship, that it approached the ship, and somehow it put Picard into a coma of some kind. And on the ship, he was in the coma for about 15 minutes. They tried all kinds of things to revive him, to disconnect him from the probe. None of that would work. But during the 15 minutes, he lived an entire life down on another planet. Fathered children, became a sage, became revered in the community. And all of this just so that planet could be remembered by someone.
Is that something?
That really affected me, that in that 15 minutes, he could have a whole lifetime of experience, which he carried with him through all the subsequent episodes. That little flute that he carried, it was given to him by that probe.
You know, when you look at ancient artwork in sculpture, there's no doubt that whatever they saw, these people who made these structures and artwork, they saw something, I think, of some extraterrestrial nature. And I keep looking in South America, for example, Lord Pakal sitting in, what looks like some kind of space apparatus. And it's all over the place down there.
Yes, if you look at one of the carvings with Pakal, he is actually standing across from a tree of life. And his son is on the other side of this tree of life. And this is called the coronation. He is actually handing the crown on to his son. But if you look at the physical size difference between these two, Pakal is about 12 feet tall, and his son is about 6 feet tall.
The 12 foot would make him a Nephilim, wouldn't it?
Yes. Or not a Nephilim, but a descendant of giants. That's one of the things that I forgot to cover, is that as their offspring became self-aware, they were also part human. And so they had some loyalty to the human race as well. Not all of them were evil. There was a king, David, of David and Goliath, who was somewhat of a fugitive for a while, and he had an army of giants that worked with him. And they were called Gibberim, and they were extremely strong, very fast. They could run as fast as a horse on bare feet, and very good with a sword. But they were loyal to David, and they preserved David's life and helped him take on a lot of armies that were much larger than his and defeat them. But they had a language that they spoke that humans could not speak. Because of their multiple rows of teeth, they could say words that humans couldn't say. And so their language became known as gibberish.
Gibberish. That's a good point. You've done a lot of homework here, Brooks. Why hasn't, and you're a mainstream scientist, but you look at it with a different angle, why hasn't mainstream science put these dots together?
I think some of them are. I communicate via email with several of them, and although they don't want to write a foreword to my book because they're purists, they too have these feelings and these thoughts, and they reach the same impasse. I communicated with Dr. Keku a number of years ago by email, and I told him that I was writing the book, and he said, well, I'll look for it to come out. But I've read his books, and several points in his books, he reaches impasses as well.
Pretty dramatic.
It's nigh to inspiration when he breaks through.
Stay with us. We'll continue chatting with Dr. Brooks Agnew. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines. It'll be your turn.
Miss part of the show? Listen online with Streamlink. Log on to coasttocoastam.com. From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Well, it sure is. On our next Coast to Coast program, Richard Dolan joins us, UFOs and the National Security. I'm looking forward to that chat with Richard indeed. Let me tell you something. He's done his homework, as has our current guest, Dr. Brooks Agnew. We'll be back with him in just a moment. His book is called The Ark of Millions of Years. We'll tell you where you can get it when we come back.